Politics, episode number 11. This week's stories:
Folksonomy rankings, the future of search;
RIAA sues a child;
Podomatic podcast portal adds iTunes support;
anonymous BitTorrent;
the new private library;
the un-Googleable;
make your own web application;
no, you cannot have children, says Indiana;
Steve Ballmer's visit to Trinity;
most sound recordings are out of public reach;
how to pick up ladies;
and our media pimp.
All that and more after this. Welcome back to week 11 of Technolitics, your weekly fusion of all that is great, good and new in technology, politics, the media, and often popular science too. I'm Gareth Stack, and I'm joined in the studio
by Jason McCandless.
Okay, our first story this week concerns Folksonomy rankings, the future of search. Specifically, a new search engine has been created to search social bookmarks. Folksonomy is a general term for social bookmarking, for collaboratively creating bookmarks and tagging them. So services like Delicious, Furl, Flickr, which collect information and allow it to be tagged socially by multiple people and share that information. So it's an aspect of the web 2.0.
And just like Technocratty tags blogs.
Exactly.
Right.
So a new search engine has been launched entitled Collaborative Rank, which searches Delicious links. And it's a research project, I think it's by a student, of the University of New South Wales in Australia. And it enables search of either specific taggers to Delicious or a more general search of Delicious. But it also allows you to see who tagged what. And it weighs search results by importance. So it calculates an importance for user. And then based on that importance for each tag, so say you're like highly ranked for the tag technology, then when somebody searches for anything under that tag, the stuff that you have tagged with technology will come up.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a reputation system, but it's automatic.
And I have a higher reputation than you do.
You might have a higher reputation than me, but as with life, it's only because you've got a higher reputation in a very few obscure areas of interest. My reputation might be lower overall, but it is higher in general.
Okay,
so user rank is calculated based on the originality and the subsequent popularity of a user's post to Delicious. So if I post something to Delicious, which is a social bookmarking site, so it kind of lets you put your bookmarks online so you can use them from any machine and anybody can look at them. So if I find an interesting new news story about aliens and I post about it, and then lots and lots of other people post, the fact that I posted first and the fact that it then became popular will move me up in the ranking for that tag, and it's calculated based on an algorithm, and then
excellent.
So it's pretty cool.
It's a great way to find quality links. It's hard to searching for something on Google, for instance.
Yeah, because there's a built-in problem with stuff like Google where it is open to all sorts of abuse. And tagging is open to abuse too, but you can filter out those users that are creating spam tags, I guess you'd call them.
Yeah, it's almost like fascist searching.
Selective searching. But the genius of Delicious is that it provides an incentive for the grind of tagging. Because tagging with Flickr, for example, is something that is very rarely done, because what's the point? The only way you tag something is so you can remember what it is. So as long as you give it a meaningful name and a date and stuff, there's not really much point. But with Delicious, when you find a cool bookmark, you're going to be able to want to find it anytime you search for it and go back and find it. So you've got really good incentive for putting loads of specific accurate tags on it. So this allows you to take all of that wisdom and human intelligence applied to bookmarks and then search them and find the best sites.
Well, I think tags in Flickr are just as important on Delicious, though.
But they're underused, though. Flickr tags, there's a tagging culture on Flickr, but then there's a whole, I would even say, a majority of users who just don't even use the tags at all.
Yeah, I know. I don't use them as much as I like to.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But tagging is a future for files. I think the WinFS system, and if you're searching for stuff, like with Google Search doesn't do it, but in the future, I think people will add tags to their files rather than just place them in any folder.
Like in good old BEOS.
Yeah.
Yeah, and semantic web type stuff is all based on user tagging and user linking rather than kind of automated crawling. It's intelligence. Human intelligence is now like harnessed as part of the intelligence of the web.
Yeah.
And vice versa. Very cool stuff. So check that out. That is Collaborative Rank, and it is linked from our wiki. As always, all of our links this week are in our wiki. So if you go on to technolitics.com and you look at the post for this week's show, you click on the wiki button, you'll get our wiki coming up, and it's got loads and loads of information, sometimes even more than we talk about on the show, and it's got every single link we mentioned. So it's really cool. Wikis are cool in general. So
yeah. And if you find an error, you can change it for us.
Yeah, you can change any kind of error, and you can even make a new page on the wiki if you like. For anything you like, you're free to do that.
The next story is the RIAA suing a child. They had a case against now 14, but she was 13-year-old Brittany Chan. But that case got dismissed from court. But now they want to sue this girl.
Yeah, I think the initial case was against her mother, and that case fell through. So they're okay, now.
Yeah, the mother wouldn't take any responsibility for the child, even though the RIAA said that the mother was like participating in the copyright infringement just because she supplied the computer. But that's ridiculous.
Isn't that insane? That's like if I walk into a cyber cafe and I like install Kazaa and download something, that they're then responsible because of what I
did. Well, they are, though.
That's insane, too.
Yeah. I mean, I've been stopped using Kazaa in an internet cafe before.
Well, I can see the reason for that. But they shouldn't be blamed for what you do, Jason.
Yes.
I hope you're downloading a Linux ISO.
I was sharing Creative Commons files. Share-alike licensed files.
Okay, moving swiftly on. This is obviously another monstrous action by the RIAA, one of many.
Irma aren't any better, though.
Imro are no better. That was a mistake I made in the first show. I called them Irma, but that's just a small Jewish woman. Imro are, in fact, the Irish Musical Rights Organization.
Ah.
Rights, yeah, being the operative word. The right not to listen to the music that they don't let you play on your podcast or radio show. The right for them to sue or stiff you anytime they like. And pay the artists. Fuck off.
Yeah.
The RIAA gloating about stuff like this. Apparently there's ads on US television, you know, saying, you know, you could be next. I think they showed an ad on the Super Bowl advertisements, which are like the most expensive advertising spot in American TV, which kind of showed, you know, I was caught. And all of the people that they showed that were caught got a little bit off their ridiculous fines for like doing this ad or didn't have to pay them.
Oh my God.
It's so manipulative.
The amount these advertisements cost, and they're just doing that to try and combat piracy. They'll probably win over America, though, I think.
Moving on, because you don't have too much information on that, but do follow the link and do stop buying the RIAA CDs. We heartily encourage you to buy independent artist CDs.
I think we should probably skip on to the anonymous BitTorrent story because it's kind of related.
Sure. Actually, we had an email during the week from a listener called Alxi, I think, and we couldn't email back because their email address does not work. So the answer to that question is in what we're about to say.
Okay, the answer to that question is a piece of software called I2P. I2P is an anonymizer layer which gives users the option to run programs like BitTorrent and the Nutella network over a secure layer that's not traceable by the RIAA.
We talked about Tor in past shows, and Tor is very useful for surfing the web and maintaining your privacy. But I2P is particularly good and particularly designed specifically for peer-to-peer programs. So if you want to get the latest Linux ISO without anyone being able to track what content you're saving, looking at what information you're sending to trackers, anything like that, I2P is the way to go.
Yeah, like you could actually do that with Tor, but do not do this. You will destroy Tor and nobody will like you.
They might actually have to limit within the protocol of Tor stuff like peer-to-peer ports because it's such a drain on the network. It's a limited bandwidth network and the bandwidth's all provided by people hosting Tor servers.
Although you can actually use Tor to connect your trackers and that's not a problem. It's just the actual data transfer. It's way too much for Tor to handle.
Cool. So to try that out, it's linked from our wiki, ITP Network, and you can either use it with Azurus or any other BitTorrent client, or you can use a custom ITP BitTorrent client. Okay, moving on.
The next story is Podomatic Podcast Portal adding iTunes support.
Okay, Podomatic is a new service. It's great for beginners, but what they're doing is they're actually letting you put your podcast on Apple's iTunes Store without having to have an American credit card. And this was a problem for us in the start when we first started off our podcast.
Yeah, are we even on iTunes yet?
Oh, we've been on iTunes for quite a while.
And so it's working?
It is working. It does work. But that's only thanks to a user who helped us out from a web board, I think, a guy called Jeff from a show called Podcast Shuffle. So do check that out if you get a chance. And Jeff used his credit card to register us, which is an amazingly nice thing to do. But what Podomatic lets you do is kind of one of these new services that are starting off that gives you 250 megs of space for free, where you can actually record straight into it and edit straight online in a really nice web app. Or you can record your podcast separately and upload it to your space, and they will register on the iTunes Store for you, which is really nice.
Excellent.
The only downside is that you are kind of then tied to using their service, and you only have 250 megs of space, and you might have to, I haven't actually checked, but I'm pretty sure you probably have to pay for more.
And there's a bandwidth limit on that?
I don't know, actually. I read through their FAQ, but I didn't see a bandwidth limit. I guess that there probably isn't, because they would want to promote their service, right?
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah.
So do check that out, especially if you're starting off podcasting and your podcasts are going to be quite short. And you can cut that down. If you record in a lower bitrate, say 56K, something like that, you can really reduce it down, even 24, if you don't mind the audio quality being too low. So you could get it, maybe a podcast down to 10, 15 megs a time.
Yeah.
So 250 megs would last for quite a while.
It's not bad for like the first few podcasts, I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Until you get it off the ground.
Until you get some financing behind you.
Next story is the new private library. I don't know if you've seen recently the whole debacle with Google Print, I think it's called. Is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah, they had like a searchable Google for books. But what's going to happen now is Yahoo, they're going to scan in scholarly books from colleges in America. And they're going to do this at no charge. And they are going to make it open. And other search engines will be able to use this.
And it's all Creative Commons as well.
Yeah.
So it's really neat. They're teaming up with the Internet Archive, and they're going to literally scan thousands and thousands of books from these collections that aren't available to anyone that are in, you know, libraries like places like Brown and Harvard and so on.
Yeah.
This is going to be all searchable from any search engine. It's going to be all online. Now, it's not stuff that's still copyright, because they're dodging that whole area. So I'm sure publishers can say, okay, add our stuff. They're not specifically going for anything copyright at the moment. So it's quite different from what Google are doing.
Yeah, I think they're trying to do this the right way around, other than getting the publishers all riled up like Google managed to do.
And you wonder to an extent, what's the point of Google's service? And now, actually, I can't see why publishers get annoyed by it. I think they're very foolish to get annoyed by it, because it's really a glorified sales tool. It's like Amazon's tool, where you can see one or two pages.
I mean, I try to use it, but you can see a few pages first of all when you're searching for something, and if you look at just a few pages, then you're then asked to log into your Google account, and once you do that, it's like there's a number of pages you can only look at as in a certain session. And
although you can hack around that, there is already some software for getting around that, which I presume it just logs you into multiple accounts one after another or something. Okay. But at the same time, it's a futile thing. I mean, it's not really a good way to get information.
And it's not like these books aren't available like from websites and peer-to-peer anyway.
Well, yeah, but publishers are understandably don't like that either. But obviously, there are examples of authors like Cory Doctorow of Boing Boing fame who've published their books to very successful sales and also given them for free Creative Commons on the net.
Proven that it is viable.
It is a viable business model. No doubt publishers would argue that there's a degree of first to market on that, and it's a publicity stunt and it wouldn't work over all books. But, you know, that's also unproven. So, you know, either way, you can look at it in a positive way. You can say that it helps sales, or you can say that it'll kill them. But I think I'll definitely go down on the side that the more information that users and readers can get about your books, the more they'll buy.
Yeah, definitely. Like, just like eBay, I think it's called Search Inside, or Amazon, of course. Yeah, eBay don't sell books. Well, they do second books. That actually proved to promote the books. It's a good thing.
But it's still very, very limited access to the books. So this new service will open from the Open Content Alliance, the grandly titled, will allow you to actually read full works online and download them. So it'll be a lot like Gutenberg Project, but include a massively larger collection of books. So do check out those links, and in the future, let's hope we can all check out the information that will come and be benefited from that. Yeah, my grammar is falling apart. We've had a rough week here.
We just got back to college. We haven't started term yet.
We've had a week of the radio station being a radio station and not just a studio for technologics, and a week of tremendous stress and chaos. So the studio is in what would be politely described as a heap.
Yeah.
And it's full of beer cans.
There's beer cans everywhere.
Corpses and
there's a dog head on the wall, but that was already there.
There's a very ugly dog head on the wall with a Rasta wig, which has to be seen to be believed. That explains our shoddiness, if shoddiness it be. So moving on to our next story.
The Ungoogleable is the next story. This is about a Wired article describing these people who never show up in Google searches. The Wired article actually, when it's talking about these people, they changed the names, which is probably a good idea.
Yeah, it's a bit of a niche touch, because of course they would be hugely Googleable if they were on Wired, it being an enormously popular website.
Yeah, these people do not ever sign up for any kind of online service. Well, if they do, then they use pseudonyms, I believe, but they don't use online banking and use their credit cards to buy things, and they don't have their phone number published.
And the article mentions that to be truly ungoogleable, you have to do stuff like not join any alumni associations, not be on any mailing lists, because that stuff always gets put online.
And never join organizations, that put stuff online. And I guess if you're even going to schools, like, this stuff can get online, so you might even want to be contacting people to, like,
not to have it removed and stuff,
Then it would be on the Google cache, though.
And on the Internet Archive.
Yeah.
But some do take it further, living completely off the grid, with no bank account, no credit cards, and no phone line. But obviously, this requires you to not pay tax. Because if you're a registered voter and you're paying tax, then governments will release your information to various departments. And if you're in the United States, your government will sell your information to private companies.
That's nice.
And you'll get lots of lovely junk mail, and you'll probably get on Google too. So this is kind of interesting, because it's an example of how government makes opting out of generalized knowledge of your identity by society impossible. And there are very good reasons for that, child safety and so on. But, it's also a deprivation of liberty.
Yeah, I think these people are a bit just paranoid, to be honest.
I don't know, maybe they're just expressing their freedom in a different way. Maybe they don't want to be. I mean, I love being Googleable. Clearly you do too, but, you know, not everyone feels that way. Not everyone wants to be findable or reachable.
Some people want to live in an anarchist society, but, I mean, the fact is we don't. We won't.
Not till the revolution. But if you're interested in becoming un-Googleable, well, if you're Googleable already, good luck. But if your newborn child
you might want to nuke their servers or something.
Don't nuke Google servers. They rule, and plus that would be vastly illegal. But, you know, if you want to disappear, we have a guide for you. It's linked from our wiki, and it kind of tells you how to vanish, specifically in America. But I guess you could use that stuff anywhere. And it's kind of stuff like super hacker Kevin Mitnick did when he disappeared for years.
Oh, yeah.
So it's those kind of techniques, how you really disappear if you want or need to.
Excellent.
So say if you're in a repressive regime, you can disappear off the grid, and you might well need to, because a new law proposed by the state legislature of Indiana in the United States will require a license to procreate by any means other than sexual intercourse. So women wishing to use in vitro fertilization, sperm donation, or any other form of non-sexual procreation will have to apply for a license for which only married women will be considered. So lesbian women or single women who wish to have children will be prohibited by law from having children unless they have sex with someone. This new law will make insemination without a gestational certificate Class B misdemeanor. And under Indiana law, this means that those convicted are liable for a fine of up to $1,000 and up to 180 days in jail.
Let's just hope they get convicted early on in that pregnancy then.
You don't want to have that sprog in the state penitentiary. A married couple requesting assisted reproduction must provide a description of the family lifestyle of the intended parents, including a description of individual participation in faith-based or church activities, hobbies, and other interests. And they are subject to fingerprinting and criminal history checks.
Wow.
There's a clear agenda behind this, I think. You don't have to look too far to see the far-right Christian conservative ugly head rearing itself behind this lawmaking, this sort of state-designated family description.
It's the Republicans, isn't it?
Not just Republicans, but I would venture Christian conservative Republicans.
Yeah.
So what do you think of this piece of legislation?
I'd say that Bush probably backs it. It's really crazy, is all I can really say. This is basically anti-homosexual, first of all. The family lifestyle, I mean, what if you're a member of the Church of Satan? I mean, are they going to consider you more or less for this thing? What can I say? But at the same time, it doesn't affect me, at least.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's okay then. As long as it doesn't affect us sitting in our warm, safe studio in the Republic of Ireland. This is a human rights issue.
Yeah, and I would imagine it is. Like, is the UN not stop this kind of shit?
The Americans don't like the UN interfering in their domestic affairs one little bit. One would imagine that the Supreme Court would strike this down. Surely this has got to be against
the freedom to do what you want.
For example, to have children.
To bear arms.
You can bear arms, but not children. I can see the posters already. But I mean, you can laugh, but this is quite a terrifying piece of proposed legislation. It's reminiscent of a book by Margaret Atwood, The Handmaid's Tale, which tells the story of America in the wake of a Christian revolution, kind of like the Islamic revolution in the 1970s in Iran and America, where women have absolutely no freedom and the reproduction is completely controlled by men, and they serve as kind of forced surrogates for wealthy families. So it is kind of almost like a nightmare. It's a dystopian vision of the future where you have to go to the state and say, please, can we have children?
It's often in science fiction of the future, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lots of science fiction. Yeah. Repro licenses, it goes back to like almost H.G. Wells, I think.
Wow. Anyway, let's move on to something less
disturbing. Serious and disturbing.
The next story is new social software called Ning. If you like websites like Flickr, Delicious, the Facebook, or even Hotter Not, you can make your own essentially clones of these websites, these social websites. You can apply it to like your interest group and have your own categories. You can also write your own code. But what Ning actually is, I think they call it a playground, like a social playground. You can copy anybody else's website. You develop your own then. They obviously host it as well. And they have their backend and their API plugins to make your development easier. They still have to like kind of iron out their policies a bit more, I think, and how they're going to make money on this. And I hope they make the right decisions as regards that. Everything you develop is viewable by everybody else. So you kind of, you have the forced open sourceness of it. But it's cool. It's good. Check it out. Ning.com.
Yeah, it's got the benefits both of the fact that people can actually get into the code and develop right there in PHP. And they can also use all these built-in APIs that Ning have kindly developed and added for them. So you can do cool stuff like if you see someone has a kind of a Flickr style service on Ning, you can copy it.
Just one button.
Just one button copy. And then you can edit that service right there in Ning and change all the variables of it or change how it works. So if you think, hey, Flickr is cool, but it would be much cooler if it was integrated in with social bookmarking or something, you can make that service.
Yeah, and they're going to be adding Ruby and Python support later. Some of the websites we're looking at so far on it are pretty cool. See, what was there? Got MILF was one of them. And there is one about
Girl on Girl. That was one.
Oh, yeah. Girl versus Girl.
So it's like Hot or Not, except you compare two people and it's two girls and you select which is the hottest. And it compiles statistics so you can scientifically evaluate who is the hottest chick.
And then there's like a geek comparison as well.
Oh, is there? Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. So this is very cool. And the quotas for app content are up to 1 gigabyte for public content. So I'm guessing that's user uploadable data. So like if it would be a map service like Google Maps or an integration with Google Maps, that might be where users tag and the information they tag. And that's up to 1 gig. So that's quite a lot of backend data.
Yeah. And it's 100 megabytes for private data and 10 megabytes for just development files.
Okay, so yeah, check that out. That's Ning, and you don't need any coding knowledge to use Ning. It is actually kind of application only, like Flock at the moment, really interesting browser software that we haven't yet used. You have to apply for developer status, but I think Ning, they're really granting it really quickly. They're just not allowing everyone because they have limited bandwidth and so on. Obviously, all these web apps are going to use a lot of server power.
Yeah, and they need to sort out their money-making
schemes.
Yes.
Schemes.
Next story is a bit closer to home. Steve Ballmer came and visited Trinity yesterday.
Developers.
Yeah, he gave a developers talk to us computer science students. He talked about a number of things. Google, of course, kind of dissing them, but not too extreme.
I think you described him as incredibly charismatic.
Yes, he is a very charismatic man.
You didn't find him bloated and pitiful?
No, not at all. He's very impressive. He was also talking about pimping Microsoft products, Office and the new Vista, Xbox 360, which was shamelessly promoted by giving out Xbox 360 binders to all of us. What else? Dissing open source, saying Linux is for like these small hosting companies and it's no stay on the desktop and they're chasing Google.
That's interesting to bring up hosting because as a lot of you might know, that Apache is the leading backend server for web pages in the entire world. It's used on
That's what he was talking about.
It's used on the vast majority of websites. So this is not a small and that runs on
what he was saying is used by the small hosting companies, like the big operations aren't using it. As well as supercomputing, he admitted like that supercomputing is completely dominated by Linux.
I mean, you could check that out, but I think that thing about hosting companies primarily being small, to the best of my knowledge, that's complete nonsense. Stuff like Akatemi, which Wired, I think, are involved in, which is a distributed bandwidth system so that websites that are really popular cannot have those huge bandwidth costs.
The /.effect.
/.effect, essentially. They're huge and they're behind lots of really big sites. They run on Linux. Our own host, DreamHost, runs on Linux. That's one of the most popular hosts on the web. And a lot of professional backends are...
There was one time that Microsoft basically been mirrored by a Linux server to stop, I think it was one of the worms, but, and of course ISS is probably taken from Apache.
Oh, undoubtedly. They've just probably just dumped all the code and rebranded it, stuck a little interface on it. No, they haven't done more that. Than that's terrible. But ISS is heavily promoted, and I think a lot of businesses use it, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's anywhere near as good as Apache. It just means that it has that huge marketing push behind it.
Yeah. He was talking also about innovation. And someone asked him a question on DRM about the TCPA. Are they actually...
Trusted Computing Initiative.
Yeah, Trusted Computing, or as Microsoft calls it, Trustworthy Computing, or as Stallman calls it, Treacherous Computing. Someone asked him, are they actually going to implement it? And I think he said they are. He mentioned the recording industries are happy about this. And
I bet
they are. He phrased it in such a way that you think, oh, there's nothing wrong with this. Oh,
he's got the best speechwriters money can buy. Of course he phrased it very well. Does innovation, did he define that as stealing from Apple or just borrowing from the best?
Well, as Picasso said, good artists copy, great artists steal.
Well, that is very true. And by that definition, Microsoft are the Picassos of the software industry. So
I think Apple stole from Xerox. But
well, Apple stole a lot of basic stuff from Xerox, but they've certainly moved on in their UI design since then.
Yeah, well, they just took a Unix core, basically, and put stuff on it. But
Microsoft have innovated not at all. I mean, I can't think of a single Microsoft innovation in the history of the company. So it's ironic that they would use that term to define themselves. Clippy, yeah.
Yeah, the paperclip.
Yeah. Clippy was very innovative, and maybe before his time, because he did have to be killed off due to unbelievable irritatingness. If you'd ever used Word and Office during the Clippy years, you'll have remembered his bright face staring out at you like a demon from the depths of Word. Anytime you started typing a letter, would you like some help with your letter? Looks like you're doing a CV.
Yeah, I'd like you to fuck off.
But honestly, if anybody actually would like to email us at crew@technolitics.com and let us know of a single Microsoft innovation, because off the top of my head, I can't think of any.
No.
It's true, Apple do borrow quite a bit. But they do it with style. I mean, they do innovate while they're doing
definitely
it.
Definitely with style.
And they do stuff like, they bought, iTunes is based on a piece of software that they bought, but they really did revamp the UI hugely. So they kept the basic core UI ideas, but they made it much nicer. Whereas Microsoft buys something and make it bloated and poor quality, like IE. So props to Apple on that. Okay, yeah.
Actually, something else that Ballmer mentioned was MSN Spaces. He had like a whole slide full of Microsoft statistics about Hotmail and everything. MSN Spaces, you know, the Microsoft, the MSN blog shit. I might add, but he said that they started, what was it, like last May, they started with 0 subscribers, and now they're the biggest blogging company in the world.
That's unbelievable.
It's silly.
And of course, Amazon Space is well known for their cooperation with the Chinese government in repressing words like democracy, freedom, rebellion. If you try and register an Amazon Space's blog with any of these words in China, it will say, you know, forbidden word.
Everyone's cooperating with the Chinese.
I think there's a world of difference between cooperating with the police service and cooperating with the police state. Mm-hmm. And of course, Hotmail was notoriously unbelievably poor before Gmail came along and shook its gizzards and terrified Microsoft into actually, I wouldn't call it innovating, but replicating. Like, was the limit, I think, on your email something like 2 megabytes?
Yeah, I think it was that low.
I've sent emails that were bigger than 2 megabytes. I mean, that's insanity. And they deleted users' email without letting them know. They deleted your email account if you didn't use it for a month. Ridiculous bullshit like that. So, you know, their web services are essentially as crap as they can make them without being completely unpopular.
I will say something Ballmer got right, though, is that blogs are a good thing. He did say, when he was talking about MSN Spaces, he said something along the like of, blogs are for freaks. But then he went on to say, no, blogging is like the best thing ever. I'm not sure if he totally believes it, but
blogs are a good thing, unless of course you've been fired from Microsoft for blogging, in which case they're a less good thing.
Well, Microsoft have their own blogs, so.
Oh, they do. They have official staff blogs, but there have been several staff fired for unofficially blogging.
Okay.
To our next story. This is the story that most sound recordings in the history of recording are out of reach of the public.
Yes, that's those bastard recording companies again.
Jason's very vociferous today.
Yeah, how many times in a podcast do we bring those bastards up?
They really are bastards. And by that I mean that their parents were not married when they slept together. No, I don't mean that at all. So this study by the Library of Congress in the United States has concluded that majority of sound recordings are unavailable. And this is due to a combination of factors, from changes in technology making old recordings unreadable to copyright holders lacking financial incentives to reissue them. In other words, they can't make enough money out of them, so they won't bother. So literally, more stuff that's been recorded in the history of sound and still exists, is still sitting in kind of reel-to-reel or whatever somewhere, is unavailable to buy than is available.
Wow.
That goes back to lots of greats from the jazz era, big band stuff, all sorts of stuff from the 30s, 40s, even studio albums from the 50s and 60s that have just gone out of print.
So it's the kind of stuff that you could only really get in a car boot sale then?
I think there were still, I think even Nick Drake had a revival a few years ago, and I think before that there were Nick Drake albums that you literally couldn't buy.
Wow.
And that's true of so many musicians these days, and generally they only get released when there's a grassroots movement which kind of gets involved in them or discovers them, and an old tape comes to light that can be restored or something. But the recording industry have no interest in this.
Yeah, the laws in this need to be completely changed. I mean, as it stands, like, the access to this stuff won't be opened up till
2067.
As Cory Doctorow said, yeah.
Yeah, and this is missing out in a great marketing opportunity as well, because there's something called the long tail, which people have been talking about for a while. And what that is that while purchases on obscure items are in a very small number, so say you have a recording of Charlie Mingus, which is from the, I don't know, the early days of his career, it's not very high quality, and you make that available, and it's only bought a few times, they are profitable enough that services like Amazon.com make the majority of their money, not from bestsellers, but from books that sell very, very few copies. So they have this huge catalog. And like with online services, the cost of having additional produce is very much lower. With Amazon, it's quite a bit lower. With stuff like iTunes, it's almost nothing. So iTunes could triple the size of its music collection at a very, very small cost compared to their actual overheads, which are mostly licensing fees.
Mm-hmm.
So when you make this stuff available, even if it only sells a very small amount, you make a huge amount of profit, and you might well make more profit from that in the long tail of sales than you do in the peak of mainstream artists and current contemporary artists. That's what's being deprived.
Yeah.
Not only are the public being deprived of listening to these recordings, but companies are being deprived of the potential profits, and artists are being deprived of the potential profits of their old recordings.
Yeah, what rights do the artists have to these recordings after they've left, like, the mainstream?
I think they have rights to royalties. They don't have rights to publication, though, so they can't just bring them out themselves. But although some artists from back in the day, I mean, comparatively recently, that they even have those rights. They used to be able to sign away their rights, and they'd be made at the start of their career, sign all rights away, and they'd get, like, a flat fee. While the recording industry bastards, as we're describing them today, slap their hands and walk to the bank with a big greedy grin.
These people need to be stopped.
They do. We need to take them down. And we recommend everything from buying CDs, which are from independent artists, to downloading Creative Commons music, to making your own music, getting out there and actually making music, and going to live gigs and supporting bands directly, not the recording industry, who are frankly a pack of leeches who don't create anything worthwhile.
Do you want to do the next story?
Okay, this is more my kind of story, do you think?
Yeah.
The story is How to Pick Up Girls. This is a new book called The Game, which has been released on the blossoming professional pickup artist scene, and teaches how to use techniques developed from neurolinguistic programming, which is kind of a pseudoscience designed to manipulate others to your advantage to increase your conquests. So the book describes a whole series of techniques to acquire as much punani as you can handle, I guess. It's written by a professional pickup artist who had apparently such success that he's now going out with a model / guitar player from the band Hole, who is a foot taller than him and gorgeous and fantastic in every way. And he's far from attractive himself. It's kind of like Eric S. Raymond's Geek Guide to Get Dating. I remember reading somewhere someone saying, oh, what right has this geek got to write a geek guide to get dating? Well, you know, if he was 6'5", muscular and tanned, there wouldn't be much point in him writing a guide, because the guide would simply be like me, and yeah, you'll get some. But this guy, he's not spectacularly attractive, and he's written a book outlining the techniques which he teaches at seminars for how to pick up women. He's done an interview on Wired in which he kind of justifies what he does. He's questioned about it, and he's asked, well, is this not, you know, manipulating women and all this sort of thing? And he says, well, yeah, it is. But to an extent, he's helping out guys who might be very, very nice guys to get through and get in touch with people who might otherwise ignore them and pass over them. And ultimately, there'll have to be something behind that for there to be a relationship stemming from that. And it's not deception. It's not lying about yourself. It's not saying you have a Ferrari or a great job when you don't. It's just presenting yourself in the best possible way.
And it's using science to your advantage.
Using science and intelligence to your advantage. And why, if someone can flex their pecs and pull, although that's obviously far too literal and 1950s beach movie cliche, but if somebody can impress with their purely physical attributes, then why not impress or indeed manipulate with your knowledge and intelligence? We haven't read that book, but we recommend checking it out. It's called The Game.
Sure, I'm sure feminists love it.
Feminists will probably read it to learn what to escape from, but they're all going out with girls anyway, so it doesn't matter. Okay, moving on.
Okay, oh, that's it. That's our show. Time to have the weekly media pimp.
Oh, my favorite part of the show. Other than the whole show, which is all my favorite part. We got a few media pimps for you this week. Do you have any pimps, actually, Jason?
I've been very busy and have nothing to pimp. Actually, no, I will pimp something. I mentioned a service before called YouTube.com. It's basically like Flickr for videos. Well, I found another one called Vimeo. I think it's Vimeo.com. It's the same kind of service, only it's a little bit different. So check it out. And see
what advantages does it have over YouTube?
The difference is, I'm not sure what the advantages are, but the difference is that you don't watch the videos in the actual browsing window. It's on a Flash plugin. You download them.
Oh, that's cool.
So, I know. Check it out and compare the two yourself.
So you can download them to your video iPod, which many sources allege will be released on
that's
Monday.
The next pimp, yeah.
Yeah, and this is a picture, an alleged picture of the video iPod, which Apple Insider have released. With I think Apple Insider are now saying that there won't be a release of the video iPod. But, you know, it's actually been taken down. I'm just looking at the page now and the picture is gone. And it's replaced by sort of a pimp for the event on the 12th. Isn't that interesting?
Interesting.
So Apple's lawyers have obviously been in touch.
Yes. I haven't actually even seen the photo yet.
It really didn't look that amazingly impressive. It looked kind of like a Nano. People are saying it looks like an iPod 60 gig. It doesn't. Based on the picture, it's longer than it is wide. So it's, you know, a lot. It's kind of more rectangular than the existing iPod. And the screen takes up about half to three quarters of the length. And a smaller scroll wheel like on the Nano.
Oh, right.
So it could easily be a mock-up. This was an alleged photo cam picture taken. But, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's a mock-up. Even if it will be released on Monday, which you'll know. I mean, we don't know. But you, listeners, in the future will know. You'll already know the answer to this question. So you'll be either going, those guys are so insightful. Or those idiots. How could anyone believe that they would release the video iPod? So maybe it'll be released on Monday.
They're releasing the video iPod at some stage. So, I mean, iTunes Video Store.
iTunes Video Store will happen. I think they're waiting just to sign up enough studios, because the recording industry, hard as they were to sign up, make Hollywood look very, very difficult. Didn't articulate that very well, but yeah. Okay, our final media pimp. Actually, there's two more.
Oh yeah, WinAmp now includes XM satellite radio. It's had this for, I think I've been using it for about 2 months. Well, I'm going to say it's shit. The streams are at like 24 kilobits per second, which is just unlistenable. Maybe a talk show is fine, but music, it just don't work, folks.
But if you're a fan of Howard Stern, this is now the only way to get him, since he's been kicked off Clear Channel for profanity and general uncouthiness.
Okay.
So if you want to listen to America's leading shock jock, Howard Stern, you can use Winamp to tune in. Also, our final media pimp is a device called the Tactipad. And I think this is only a mock-up. It presumably does exist, but I don't see a purchase thing on the page.
So it's kind of like the Optimus keyboard. Is that it?
The Optimus keyboard.
The OLED, the keyboard with the LCD display for each key.
You can buy this.
No, you can't.
Yeah, I've seen them.
No, you can't.
You can. I swear to God, I've seen them. They do exist. We used to sell one in Pete's.
An LCD display on each key of the keyboard.
Oh, no. This is like a projected keyboard.
Oh, they're really cool, but no, that's a different.
Okay, what are you talking about?
The Optimus keyboard, I think it was called, that the Russian guy, the designer, developed. It has like an LCD display on each key, which changes depending on which application you're using. So if you're playing Quake or Photoshop,
there are any keys
or typing. Yeah, it's like a normal keyboard, but at the top of each key is an LCD display.
Oh, okay.
A tiny little like matrix of LCD.
That sounds kind of naff.
Oh, check it out. You should have seen that.
Yeah, okay. Check that out. This is the thing called the Tactipad. And it, what it essentially is a trackpad, but it's more advanced than your standard trackpad in that it allows two-handed haptic feedback. So it not only does it allow you to use multiple kind of parts of the pad at once, and both your hands at once, but it gives you feedback in the form of parts of the pad pushing against your hands. So for example, if you move over an icon, you'll get a little tap on your finger, or if you draw a circle, perhaps where you're drawing is pushed up as you move it.
Yeah, the video looks amazing.
Video looks very cool.
Want it.
You see this kind of shadow of your hands on the pad somehow generates a shadow image on the screen. So what you essentially see is representation of your hands as you move them. So you can do all these really neat things, like kind of mouse gestures, but they're literal gestures, I guess. It's demonstrated using a vector application in the video. So if you're drawing a triangle, you can just literally draw a triangle with your finger. You can drag tools out. You can scroll and move and pull and stretch and do all these really Minority Report kind of things using this trackpad. It's really sweet.
I just love the feedback, though, the way you can feel a clicker.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Jason was drooling watching this video. He really enjoyed it.
Well, not that much, but...
Okay, moving on.
Just wrap another episode of Technologics up, I think.
Oh my gosh. We've gone on to our 11th episode. And for those of you who had difficulties understanding what was going on in the last episode, let me explain. It mightn't have been clear to iTunes users who might automatically just download the latest episode of each podcast. Last episode was in three parts. So if it just kind of started midway through and didn't have headlines at the start or didn't have an end, that's because you didn't get the rest of it. So go back onto iTunes and select Technologics, open it up and look at all the past casts, and you'll be missing part one and part two, or part two and part three. So go back and you can either manually download them from our site, or you can just select them to be downloaded in iTunes. And in fact, with iTunes, you can change in the podcast settings, you can change it so that it downloads all posts from a feed. And that's a good setting to turn on, because that means that if multiple casts are released in a period of time faster than iTunes updates, so if somebody adds like 3-4 casts in within a couple of minutes, then you'll get them all. We recommend you do that, because otherwise you'll have missed like most of the show, which was 90 minutes long. Thank you for listening. We're of course at technologics.com, and our email address is crew@technologics.com.
Yep. If you want to see the stories we're deliciousing throughout the week, our feed is on technologics.com.
It's on the sidebar, but yeah, you probably won't be able to see that unless you use Firefox. So.
Yeah, that could need to be fixed.
We have a couple of bugs. We'll get them fixed. Okay, thank you for listening.
Later.